Thank you. Yeah, I found that really interesting and very clearly put. And I think it's a very important subject as well. I think whenever we refer to Marx, it's important for us to sort of relate it to the present day and things which weren't so much of an issue in Marx's day, such as the welfare state. And I think it's always good to show and prove how Marx's theories still apply, even though economic conditions or aspects of the economic system have changed since his day. So yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, that's great stuff. A couple of things spring to mind that I'd like to hear your thoughts on, and anyone else's. I think the assumption is that society functions, or capitalist society functions better when there's a sufficiently prominent welfare state, because it sort of, aims to get workers back into a position where they can be employed rather than being economically inactive. And I think that the assumption is that if there wasn't a welfare state, then a lot of things would grind to a halt, because the market, given free rein, wouldn't be able to support people who were economically inactive without relying on charities, much like it was prior to the 19th century. I was just wondering if you could sort of imagine if society could function, or if capitalist society rather could function without a welfare state, or would it then sort of regress into something more akin to how it was in the 19th century? And also, as well, if I could crowbar a second question in, I was wondering what your views were on the sort of role in society of people who have to rely almost 100% on the welfare state. I mean, a lot of the people I support in work have relied on benefits ever since they were, ever since they became adults, and probably came from families who relied heavily on benefits beforehand. So there are a number of people who will never be employed, and therefore rely wholly on benefits throughout their lives. But of course, obviously, they use that money to spend in the economy. But I was just wondering if there was anything more to say about their sort of economic role within capitalism, people who are completely economically inactive, maybe due to health conditions that prevent them from being employed. Thank you. Yeah, cheers.
Yes, well, I think that is one of the origins, your last point is one of the origins of the welfare state. Part of it is a successor to the poor law. There are people who are unemployable, or they wouldn't produce enough if they were employed to cover their own wages, or let alone the profits. I mean, capitalism just can't let these people starve and die, so they're part of the expenses the capitalists have to pay they have to pay for these people. And they pay them the minimum that they can get away with, I think to come back to Marx, even in his day there were about 10% of the population who were paupers, as they were called, and it's still about that today. I think capitalism has to has to maintain them. So that's one aspect of the welfare state. But the other one, I think, would be explain why capitalism brought in the welfare state and why it really couldn't function without it. Because the more educated and the more healthy workers are, the more productive they are. So this is in their interest, the capitalist class interest, to have a reasonably trained and reasonably healthy, workforce. So that's the other aspect of the welfare state. And the third one is going back to Marx again, I'm afraid. He said that capitalism needs a reserve army of unemployed, so that when there's a boom, they can draw on these people and put them to work, and then they when there's a slump, they go back to being unemployed. I mean, that's the logic behind unemployment benefit. I mean, they have to maintain their these workers fit to work in between booms. So I mean, that's the third reason why there's a welfare state. And as I said in the talk, this pay as you earn thing enables capitalists to ensure that a single worker doesn't get paid too much, family allowances and so on, and tax things like that. So I think I would say that capitalism can't do without the work without the welfare state for these three reasons. One, they have to maintain the poor, the unemployable. Two, they need to properly train, educate, and keep healthy the permanent workforce. And third, they need this reserve army of labour to pay for them to keep their working skills while they're not working. I hope that explains.
Paddy, you're next, but can you see there's a comrade from the WSPI in the speaking queue, but he's not in the meeting? What can we do with that?
I've just answered him. I've told him we're in a meeting, Mike, and actually I invited him to come in.
Thank you, Steve.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Okay, I believe he's a sympathiser. But he's not actually in the meeting. I'll send him another message. Okay, sorry about that.
That's okay. Paddy, go ahead now then.
Thanks. I enjoyed that. It was really interesting. I think it was I learned things about the Pike case on tax, which I've been a bit confused about. Something else I'm confused about, though, a little bit, and I've heard this from elsewhere. And you alluded to this, Adam, quite early in your talk, but I think you kind of explained it, but I think you went too fast and I missed it. So what I'd like to ask is this idea that the governments have a deliberate policy of devaluing the currency, presumably by, overprinting the currency or something like that. But anyway, you said that governments have a deliberate policy of devaluing the currency by approximately 2% a year, which amounts to 20% over 10 years, 50% over 30 years. I didn't understand the reason why the government would do that. I wonder if you could maybe just revisit that point to clarify. Thanks.
Well, there are two reasons. The one is that I mentioned. Well, they're both mentioned by Keynes, actually. I mean, the first one is his point that workers will resist less a cut in their real wages through prices rising than they would, resist a direct cut in their money wages. Because he was writing in the 1930s, when in fact this did happen, the cost of living did go down, and there were actual cuts in people's money wages. So that was one thing. But I think the main reason he advocates this is that if prices are slowly rising, then this is an incentive too for capitalists to produce, because they think the market is expanding. But I say that when I put it in the first four points, the first three apply absolutely, but that fourth point is just something that happens now under contemporary capitalism. It didn't happen in the 19th century, and it didn't happen between the wars, but it's now, as I say, the official policy in England, and I think it's the same in the United States. The government in England says to the Bank of England, your remit is to keep inflation around, on average, 2% a year. And that's their policy. But as I say, the logic behind it will be those two reasons I mean. But it doesn't have to happen. I mean, they could say to the Bank of England, have no inflation, keep it around zero. But I don't think any country in the world does that.
Thanks for that, Adam. I see Dougie's in next. Do you want to go ahead, Dougie?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to people about the tax thing, and a lot of people say, yeah, I know the capitalists pay the tax, but if I reduce the tax, I'll have more money in my wages. So that there's a slight argument against that. Although I know what you're saying, that because we used to write the cheque for workers' wages, and we used to write the cheque for the tax. So I could understand why it's the employer that pays the tax. But I mean, a lot of workers think if I pay less tax, I'll get more money in my wages. One thing I'd like to say, in America, you know, where they don't have a proper healthcare system, they've got Medicare and things like that. I mean, it's in the interest of a lot of capitalists for them to have a welfare system like Britain. But there seems to be a thing from the Republicans that they don't want to support that. And I just wonder, is it different capitalist interests that are against having a welfare system, you know, for healthcare for the workers? Because really, it would stop workers having to pay insurance for healthcare in America, if you see what I mean. So I just wonder how that affects America. I know we've got healthcare and we've got the National Health Service in this country, but Americans struggle a bit, really, yeah.
I think in America, don't the big corporations have their own welfare schemes? In other words, it's sort of privatized, and the people that don't, you know, don't work for these big companies or don't work at all, who are caught out. Because even you know, the welfare reforms in America were opposed by some workers, because it would mean a leveling down of what they got from their private healthcare schemes. In fact, there was a bit of that when national insurance was introduced after the Second World War in Britain. But I think also in America, although there aren't federal schemes, there are schemes at state level. So it's not as efficient, and it's got more holes which people can fall through, but it's still there, basically, I think.
Okay, thanks, Adam. Mark said, you're next, ready to go?
Yes, thanks, Adam, very much. I've got a question about the whole welfare state issue. Isn't it the case that we're used to the idea of the welfare state, especially in Western Europe, but around the world, I think, doesn't capitalism operate in many places without really any welfare state, or a very, very minimum type of welfare state? I'm at a loss to understand why capitalism per se needs a welfare state. For example, why there's no problem for capitalism if 10-20% of the population doesn't have much to eat. I mean, they can scavenge, they can be helped out by relatives, family, they can have a bit of land of their own. Isn't really the welfare state a product of the struggle of workers? So it's actually a product of the workers' movement, rather than a sort of a necessity of capitalism. Anything that the capitalists give, isn't it sort of a scrap just to maintain their position of power, rather than anything required by the system? And maybe connected with that, I've also got a question about the whole question of the whole issue of inflation. I presume that if inflation isn't required, again, it is not required by capitalism, is it? So if it has been decided that it's a good idea, it's just a tactic to maintain power rather than for the system to exist.
Yeah, well, to deal with the last point first, yes, I think inflation, or the policy of inflation, isn't inherent in capitalism. It is a policy, but it only became possible as a policy when you had managed currencies. If you had the gold standard, it wouldn't work. So it's only something that's become possible, well, since the beginning of the last World War. But on the other question, the capitalists are not going to introduce anything unless it benefits them. And I think that the who was the first welfare state? It was Bismarck in Imperial Germany, and it was done. It wasn't done under pressure from the workers. It was done because they wanted to have to industrialize and so on. And I think I can't see. I mean, even in the economically backward capitalist countries, the main workforce employed in big industry, or in the civil service and local government, they need to be educated. They need to be properly trained, and they need to be fit to do the work. So, okay, there's a surplus population to the requirements of capitalist industry in those countries, and those people have to fend for themselves, and I don't think in those countries they could afford, the capitalist class could afford the same level or the same coverage of education and health as they can in advanced capitalist countries. But I mean, I don't think that the welfare state was introduced under pressure from workers. Obviously, trade unions and so on did exercise pressure for them, but I think it was introduced because it was in the capitalist interest.
Right. Howard Moss, ready this week?
Nearly asleep, yeah. Yeah. That was very enlightening, Adam. It really was, especially for me on the issue of taxation. The one other thing I'd say is that I also found parts of it a bit mechanical. For example, and I'll only give this one example because it's the main thing for me. You're saying that. You made a distinction between the cost of living and the standard of living. And you said, you can't sort of change the cost of living, as it were. It remains constant. And you presented that as an argument against reformism. Whatever reformists do, they're not going to be able to change that. But if I were a member of the Labour Party, I'd say, never mind about the cost of living. The important thing is the standard of living. That if you compare now with, I don't know, the 1930s, even if, the cost of living has sort of measured in the way it sort of gets measured today is sort of, as it were, constant, the standard of living has gone up dramatically. And the reason for that is that, there's been sort of pressure on governments to bring in reforms to allow people to have some of the goods and services they didn't have in the past, and have better standards of goods and services, and therefore have a better standard of living. So, I mean, what's the argument against reformists who say, look, forget about this stuff, about things can't change fundamentally. They can nevertheless change in certain details, and this can benefit workers over a period of time anyway, sort of quite substantially.
No, I agree that it was put over a bit mechanically. I mean, what I'm saying is that wages are tied to the cost of living, if you like, in the sooner or later. I mean, it isn't if the cost of living goes up or down, it doesn't automatically. It's not indexed. The wages don't go up. Or down, there'll be economic pressure set in motion, which will lead to wages going up or down. But as I think I tried to make at one point, that workers have to, workers can help these economic things, or they can hinder them. I mean, when the cost of living goes up, workers can ensure that their wages go up sooner rather than later if they organise into trade unions. And similarly, when the cost of living goes down, they can slow down the. So I mean, it's you know wages are not like other commodities. They're embodied in people who can struggle, and they do. Now, I mean, the standard of living is the actual goods that people consume, and I don't think we can we can deny that people consume, or most people consume, you know more goods than they would have done in the 60s, 50s, 40s, or 30s. But what would be the reason for this? I mean, one reason I'm sure will be that people work is more intense. So if work is more intense, people need to consume more to be able to work more intensely. It's mechanical or even chemical thing. If the harder you work, the more you have to consume to be able to work. That would be my explanation for why people standard of living has gone up slowly over the years and continues to go up. Actually, the standard of living is going up slowly, but it's not a going up automatically, but it's I don't think it can be influenced anyway by what workers or by what governments do. But the point I'm making against reformism, if a reform is something which will result in the cost of living, but not necessarily the standard of living going down, it will lead to downward pressure on wages, but it'll set in motion economic forces which will tend to bring this about. And that would be our case against, for instance, UBI. If everybody was to be paid by the government a certain sum of money, then the employers wouldn't need to pay it. I mean, it could be swings and roundabouts. As I say, the standard of living might be the same, but wages paid by the employer would go down. The same with free transport. Or if the Brexiteers are right, they do all these deals which reduce the cost of imported food. That would similarly have an effect. So all these things which people do, and Dougie was saying, if we get a tax decrease, if that would mean we would get more take home pay. It would mean that, but for how long? For how long? And everything is confused by the fact that prices are rising all the time anyway, because of this other thing, this policy of 2% inflation. So it's not evident what is happening or how you can work out which forces are operating. But as I say, we've got an example now in front of us. There's a shortage of HGV drivers, and whether they're organising trade unions or not, the employers are offering more money. It'll only be temporary, but I mean, because there's a labour shortage, the economic forces are bringing about an increase in wages.
Well, thank you very much, Adam. Steve, you're next.
Yeah. Thanks, Adam. Coincidentally, what I was just saying was has something to do with what I wanted to ask. But first of all, I mean, could I just come back to something that that Mark was asking about do they need do capitalists need a welfare state? And Adam, I mean, Adam perfectly well answered it, but there's another aspect of it that we didn't that Adam didn't mention, which is that it wasn't just workers that were able to force sort of developments in the welfare state. reading Marx, it looks like what we call civil society, that the doctors and the and government, the factory inspectors, for example, were putting pressure on the capitalists, because they realised that they seem to have a wider view of the interests of capital to other wealthy workforce. And then when you take into account the sort of infectious diseases, that will be absolutely detrimental to the interests of the capitalists, but the individual capitalists aren't going to see that. So that's why that's been part of how common welfare system came around. In terms of the US, I mean, basically, this is like anecdotal evidence, but talking to people and listening to crap on the telly, you'll hear that not having a state welfare system, or a particularly good state welfare system in terms of the health, is an extremely good way to keep the workers cowed. Right, if you lose your job, you lose your health benefits, and that is a really major factor. It would seem, talking to family and acquaintances. But if I could just go on to my other query, and I'm afraid it goes to a bit Marxist, Adam, which is about immiseration, and I wonder how we deal with that claim that workers would be increasingly worse off under capitalism, when it's quite plain that on a consumer level we're able to have access to much more than people did in the past, providing we're unemployed, of course. And the only thing that I can that I can come up with as an answer to this is that never mind the fact that we've got flat screen televisions or whatever, the productive power of society has increased so much that relatively it's difficult to see whether or not we're actually relatively better off in comparison to the capitalist class, or whether that there's some sort of this relative immiseration, which I'm a little bit as I was talking, thinking, well, what's gone on in recent years is that the value of the stuff that we have access to as workers has dropped enormously. There is not the same value in inherent to the things that we can buy. So yeah, I'll leave it at that. So sorry if that went a bit rambly.
Yeah, well, on the last point, the tendency, if there hadn't been inflation, would be for prices to go down. I mean, things become cheaper and cheaper as productivity goes up. I mean, this isn't evident because of, say, the permanent low level inflation. But I know we used to get involved much more in the past in arguments about what Marx meant, but I don't think Marx did envisage increasing pauperization of the working class. I mean, I know that Stalin in the 1930s said that this was an absolute law of capitalism. But I mean, the various arguments that we use to counter that is that Marx talks about increasing misery, which is not necessarily the same as increasing poverty. Increasing misery would be that life becomes more alienated, more miserable, which of course is more difficult to measure. But I mean, you're right. I mean, in the 19th century, when there were no restrictions on how long adult males could work, there was pressure to bringing the factory acts, which limited, you know, the working day. And, you know, Marx's point on this was that the more far-seeing capitalists or governments could see where this was leading to. It would lead to, you know, the physical degeneration of the workforce if they were overworked. So the factory acts were, you know, were brought in to stop this, and they resulted in the intensification of labour. I mean, at the, you know, at the moment, I'm scanning in articles from the Socialist Standard of 1908 and 1909, and there are articles in there about Port Sunlight and Bourneville, where the, you know, the capitalists provided, you know, good conditions for their workers, and they actually said, look, this produces for us a better workforce, and they produce more. I mean, that would be the, you know, some more far-seeing capitalists can see the, you know, can see the logic of you know, if you want you know, better milk, you provide a better pasture. I mean, that was the argument that you know, whatever the man was called, Lever, I think it was, in Port Sunlight, and some Quakers, wasn't it, in Bournemouth. So that even in Marx's day, there were far-seeing employers who realised this, but the, I mean, employers, especially in America, tend to take a, you know, a short-term view, whereas, you know, the government's role is to look after the wider and longer-term interests of the capitalist class as a whole.
All right, thank you again, Paddy. Adam. Paddy, you're next.
That's quite interesting what you just said, Adam, because that kind of ties into what I was thinking, which was, it's only a small point, really, I guess, but you know, we tend to talk about capitalism as if it's this, you know, this thing, this kind of, I don't know, this entity that's the same everywhere. But it's not the same everywhere. And this point was brought home quite strongly to me. Some years ago, I listened to I think it was a radio interview, was it Radio 4 or something. Anyway, it was this British guy, in fact, who's from Britain. He just happened to have the job of running the rail system in the Netherlands. Don't know how he got that job, but there you go. That was his job. He was in charge of that. And so the interview was asking him, you know, about this and about how it all worked. And he had some really kind of revealing things to say about capitalism, which really made me kind of sit up and take notice. And what he said was, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, he said, well, he said in Britain and in America as well, there's this kind of, and he called it an Anglo-Saxon view of capitalism, which would broadly translate to a kind of free market idea of capitalism, where, you know, the company has to, you know, make its own profit and stand or fall by its success in the marketplace. And he said, what you find in Europe, you find it in Netherlands, France, Germany, and all these places, is that they just don't have this view of capitalism. They have a much older view. They have a sort of like a view that was kind of, you know, grew up in the Middle Ages, really, of, is it much more statist conception, much more centralized, much more, you know, central control. And their idea is that the state controls these things. It's not the market, it's the state. And What this means is that he said he found it very easy to be in charge of the Netherlands rail system because it was so heavily subsidized. And he said, you see this all over Europe. You see all the rail systems in Europe have always been subsidized. It's not questioned. Why is it subsidized? Well, because of all the invisible income, you know, all the invisible revenues that come from an efficient rail service. And he cited, I don't know, things like, business, commerce, industry, agriculture, health, education, tourism, you know, all these kind of things. There were invisible benefits which an efficient rail system delivered. But it would only do that if it was subsidised, you know, below its cost. So if you tried to make the rail system in Europe pay for itself in the sort of Anglo-Saxon free market way, it just wouldn't function. It wouldn't be able to function. It wouldn't be able to deliver all these kind of hidden costs, hidden incomes, hidden revenues. So anyway, that conversation that he had had an effect on me, because it made me realise that sort of that people don't have, you know, there isn't this one view of capitalism. There isn't this one capitalism. There are multiple capitalisms. You know, they all work ultimately in the same way. They're all kind of variations on a theme. But it did strike me that when Adam was talking earlier about, you know, the logic, in inverted commas, the logic of having a national health service in Britain, but they don't have it in other countries, don't have it in America, they don't see the logic. You know, they have this... Yeah, America has this Anglo-Saxon view of capitalism, which doesn't see the hidden benefits, the invisible income of a state health service in the same way that in Britain we do. So, it was only a small point really, but I think it is worth keeping in mind that in different places and different countries, you know, people have different conceptions of what capitalism actually is. So, so that was really my point. Thanks.
What you were talking about, I think, has been called the Rhineland model of capitalism, as opposed to the Anglo-Saxon model. But on the railways on the continent, I mean, they were originally built for military in mind, because they were developed, weren't they, before the First World War, and no private railway thing was necessarily going to build railways that had strategic interest. But I mean, there are things like the railways and gas and so on. I mean they were in Britain. it was a Tory government that established the Central Electricity Board. I mean, there's only one electricity network, there's only one gas network, there's only one rail network. And I think the Tories under Thatcher, for ideological reasons, they try to create a artificial competition in these things. It's all coming unstuck. All these gas suppliers are going bankrupt. Half of the railway, private railway people, are going bankrupt. So obviously they must have taken, from a capitalist point of view, a mistaken policy. It makes more sense from capitalist point of view, which they presumably don't understand, in the Rhineland area, that these things should be done centrally. But I'm not sure that I suppose there are some, the advantages are mainly advantages of efficiency and saving money and not having them done by competing groups. And also, I can't imagine that any of the continental countries would denationalize their postal services. Anyway.
Right. Thanks again, Adam. That's good information there. Mike Foster, you're next.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Steve made a similar point to the one I was going to make, so I won't repeat that. So yeah, thanks, Steve, for bringing that up. And maybe just quickly to follow on to what Paddy just said. And yeah, I think he's right to say that we should emphasise that capitalism isn't some monolithic sort of cast in stone system, and it obviously manifests itself in different ways according to different local conditions, different dominant ideologies, different levels of technology, of course, over time, as well as over geographical distance. So yeah, I suppose the trick is to explain how the basic framework, economic framework of capitalism, is malleable enough to manifest itself in different ways according to different local priorities and local conditions. And I think that's what we do anyway. But again, I suppose it's emphasizing that capitalism is dynamic and adaptable and not some static monolith. Yeah, cheers, thanks.
Do you want to say anything, Adam? No? In that case, right.
That about the about the Rhineland model. One of the consequences of it is that the people working in these state industries have got good good pensions and virtual security of employment. But it means that another section of the working class has got precarious conditions. And I think the division in the working class in this model is worse than it is in England.
Okay. Freddie, you're next. You want to go ahead?
Yeah. Evening all, and thank you, Adam, for the briefing, the discussion tonight. It certainly clarified for me some issues that, in terms of when talking to other workers about who pays tax, etc. And I say clarified, a greater degree of clarity in the sort of everyday talk, everyday speech, or everyday words that you use there, rather than trying to quote from Marx, etc., and the examples that you give. And I can largely agree also in terms of what Paddy was saying a little bit earlier on about in America. I mean, we all know that ultimately capitalism is capitalism. And it can vary from one degree or another. It's just this question about the healthcare. I mean, was it not the case? I mean, to what degree it would model itself on our NHS, and when I say our NHS, I know it's not me personally, but anyway, on the NHS, was there not some considerable discussion and debate, etc., in America, though, about, I think it was generally against sort of called Obamacare, which had similarities, did it not, on how the NHS is. So, I mean, what I'm saying is, I think workers do generally, across the globe, to large, certainly in industrialized countries, do look to a sort of more NHS type of thing. But it's this, do you see any similarities, or any other member see the similarities to what we have here and what this Obamacare thing is, or if I get that mixed up? Thank you.
Isn't Obamacare based on compulsory private health insurance like we have in this country for car insurance? I think it was definitely involved the insurance companies in a way which you know, the National Health Service doesn't. So I think that was, you know, one of the arguments against it as well that were used by some people. But I mean, it's a reasonable demand, isn't it? I mean, if you want to talk about you know, an increase in the standard living as opposed to the cost of living, I mean, a free national health service is an advantage to, you know, to workers. Even though, I mean, some of the things are not free anymore, are they? Dentists aren't free, but basically, it's I would say it's advantageous. But whether I don't think Obamacare had that in mind. And in the now famous Rhineland model, they have an insurance system as well, but it's not private insurance companies. It's state, but you can still get virtually free. You only have to pay about 10% of the cost. But I mean, it's just bringing out the point, isn't it? That we've just been discussing, that different capitalist countries have different traditions and find different solutions to the problems that they face.
Right, Richard.
If I could just come back on that, let me just very briefly, if you don't mind, please. Probably then have a misunderstanding, because my from what I recall about this Obamacare was, it wasn't just the the insurance companies, etc., that were looking at this. It was. Maybe my misunderstanding then. I thought it was looking more at how the NHS was run here, because I remember them trying to draw parallels at one point as to an NHS type model. But if it was insurance companies, yeah, I can understand what's been said there also. But anyway, thank you.
No, you're right. It wasn't just insurance companies. There was an element of government subsidy to it.
Richard Butterell.
Thanks. Very good talk. Not just Adam, but other contributors as well. My understanding of Obamacare was that it's basically the government forcing the insurance companies to take on clients who they otherwise wouldn't, because they're too high a risk or they couldn't pay very high premiums, and that the state would subsidize them. So the health insurance companies in the USA would receive some money so they could get much fuller coverage. And I thought it was that, well, mainly that's how it has ended up as being a very, you know, a small improvement. I thought there's a pamphlet by the WSP US, and in there, I think it was about Obama in general, but it was making the point about, they're basically looking at his record and how the Glenn's much more ambitious scheme for something far more like the NHS gradually gets whittled down into this, you know, sticking plaster thing. And it's still meeting a great deal of opposition from vested interests who basically they just don't want to pay for it. And this is like one of the central arguments, isn't it, with the welfare state and whether taxes are high or low, that ultimately it's a capitalist class who have to pay, and it's whether they want to pay as individuals, in other words, like paying for your employees into healthcare like Bupa or Nuffield or something, or whether they club together. And that means the states, the capitalists club together to pay for something. And you may or may not get a better system. The arguments being that you've got some economies of scale there if these things are paid for through taxation. I think that's a bit crude, but it's a sort of... I think that's more or less true. Wasn't actually what I was going to talk about. I was just going to say briefly about inflation. And one of the, I agree what Adam says about this, having a sort of an ideal level of inflation that for most, for capitalism, most economists would agree that a low level of inflation is a good thing. What you don't want to happen is to undershoot and drop below zero. If you get into a deflationary situation, that will lead to a slump or prolong a slump, because those who have money to buy, and it doesn't matter what it is really, buying goods and services, if they think it's going to be cheaper in the future, they may wait. They will wait for prices to drop rather than buying it now. And part of the success of, you know, getting the economy going, keeping the economy going, is that if you think prices are going to rise, and they generally will, whatever you're going to buy, whether you're a consumer or you're running a business, you'll buy whatever it is, right? You're going to buy that fridge tomorrow and take out a loan, because you know, you might not have the money now, but you know the prices are going to go up. So better buy one now and borrow the money. It's actually worth it. It's worth borrowing money to have that and avoiding higher costs later on. If you don't think the prices are going to go up, then you can get an economic slowdown. Well, you can argue against that, I suppose. It's just the way I've looked at it in my rather simplistic view. But just thought I'd throw that in and see what others think about it. Thanks.
Well, actually, that was the main reason that Keynes did advocate low level inflation. He thought this was the best condition for capitalist production. But he also, as I say, made his other point about, you know, workers being more, you know, less reluctant to you know, resist a decrease in their real wages through inflation than a direct reduction in their wages. But actually, I was one thing about America is it still is federation. The states themselves can bring in their own welfare systems, and I imagine that in a state like California or New England, they do have a similar, you know, welfare state system to what we've got here. But in the southern states and places like, you know, Texas and the Midwest, they haven't got the same system, and America is a federation, but the federal power isn't as strong as the central government in places like Britain.
Right. Don't forget, you can put yourself in the speaking queue if you want to say anything. I'm in it now, so I'm going to make something out. I always thought that the British welfare system came in after the Second World War, because people who ran England and the British Empire found that the level of health and the height of the soldiers that they conscripted were so bad that that's why they introduced the National Health Service, to have healthy soldiers for cannon fodder, as the old phrase used to be. I always thought that was the main reason that they brought that in. I might be wrong, but Adam, you mentioned that the workers can use unions in this country, but increasingly there are less sort of unions around. The jobs are becoming ununionized. all these little companies to set up and say, well, you pay for everything yourself. Isn't that going to drive the standard of living or the cost of living down?
Well, yes, I think that was the intention of all this anti-union legislation that coming from the 70s, in which the Labour government didn't amend except for slightly. I mean, most trade unionists today, I think, are working for the government or semi-state things like education or the National Health Service or for local government. I mean, that's where the unions are. Strongest, but of course, manufacturing industry anyway has declined a bit. But to come to your original point, I think that was why it was brought. Something was brought in before the First World War, not after the Second World War. It was the soldiers who were recruited to fight in the Boer War, the last Boer War at the end in the 1890s. So many of them were rejected as unfit. So there was a military reason as well for bringing in some. I think Lloyd George bought some things in the old age pensions and things like that, even before the before the First World War. But I mean, there was a sort of there was an insurance system for some workers in Britain even before the welfare state came in with the Labour government. What they did was to extend it to everybody.
Right, thanks for that. Howard, you're next.
I just wanted to confirm that Obamacare wasn't an attempt to bring the NHS to the United States. I've looked it up on the internet and I'll just read what it says very briefly. It says, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, was signed into law in 2010. The Act aimed to provide affordable health insurance coverage for all Americans. More or less what somebody, I think Adam said. The Affordable Care Act was also designed to protect consumers from insurance company tactics that might drive up patient costs or restrict care. So sort of different in kind, really, from the NHS in this country. And indeed, the NHSs which exist are actually much better funded in many other European countries, such as Germany, Italy, France, etc.
I don't think you're going to say anything, Adam. Jane and Tony, you're next.
It's already been said, it was the thing about, well, it all started up following the high rate of rejections with the Boer War and then the First World War. It was with national insurance schemes that were actually fought against by large sections of the trade union movement, and then on to the welfare state after 45. It was just, yeah, so it's been said basically anyway. Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you for that. My knowledge of English working class only goes back to the 1930s. I've never studied it before. I used to study the Irish working class and the famines and all that sort of stuff. Anybody else want to say anything? Janet, were you trying to get in sometimes? Because I've seen you came in and then you disappeared. You never hit the queue. Okay, Steve, go ahead.
Sorry, I saw Janet in the queue as well, so if she wants to speak, let Janet go first.
Do you want to say anything, Janet? Because you've been looking like you're trying to.
Okay then, Mike. Just wanted to bring in, again, or rather stress what part of what Adam was saying about the way that we've come back now to the Tories saying, well, we'll subsidise this gas production, the carbon dioxide production company, while they've got these really high gas prices. This is obviously some strategic need that the system has got. And they're willing to go back in and renationalise parts of them. So it's just a complete nonsense what the left tell us, as we've always known. But again, we've got more and more illustrations of the fact that our case is sound, that nationalisation will occur if it suits the capitalist class. And you know, I just recall what struck me as really strange in the it must be the 80s now, the argument about Westland helicopters, where Michael Heseltine was absolutely firm on the idea of maintaining the engineering capability to have local for local military strategic purposes, and it strikes me as weird that the left can't ever recognise that these people are willing to take over things for on behalf of the capitalist class. Okay, that's all.
Actually, Boris has stolen the Labour Party's clothes. I mean, he's prepared to have the state intervene. He's promising high wage economy. That's what the Labour Party has been promising for ages. I mean, it won't happen, but it looks as if Thatcherism is well and truly dead and buried in the Tory Party at the moment. In fact, I see that to come back to the Rhineland model, but Boris has been described as a Gaullist. You know, that use the state to set the targets for capitalism and so on.
Very quickly, Mike, please. This is what Johnson said. In his Conservative Party speech, and the really interesting thing I think about it is that this scum has gone using the nonsensical idea about the racist tendencies in the working class, to tell us that it's the immigration that kept wages low, kept growth low, kept skills low. And this is just absolutely appalling what this bastard says. I'll just leave that there for you to consider. I think it's absolutely vile.
It's not even true, because one of the when they first got Brexit, I mean they used this stuff to get the vote, but afterwards they didn't. They went out of their way to say to EU citizens in Britain, please stay. If you apply for resident status, if you've been here for 5 years, you'll get it. If you haven't been here for 5 years, you'll get it when you have been 5 years. I mean, they wanted to keep them here because they realised that they were needed to fill some of these low paid jobs. So they've come unstuck, of course, because. Not so much because people don't want to come and work here because of the paperwork to import stuff into Britain. So it's a direct consequence of Brexit. But I mean, Boris is trying to make the best of a bad job, is saying we intended this to happen and we want a high wage thing. But I mean, it won't happen. They'll still be low wages when when the Tories are at the next general election.
Thanks for that comment.
If I may, Chairman, the Adam Smith Institute and the capitalists, the industrial capitalist class are absolutely fucking enraged by what this bugger's saying, aren't they? So, just to back up what Paddy was saying before, but do not see the capitalist class as one monolith. They're not. They've got divisions and they are played out in public. But, yeah.
Richard Butterill, you're in the queue. You go ahead.
Okay, yeah. It's just, I've always thought, and I'm not, this isn't an original thought really, but in terms of looking at the capitalist class and various wings of it, that the Labour Party tended to favour, or the other way around, let's say, the manufacturing sectors, the more industry, tend to be support the Labour Party, while services and the financial sector have been more donors to the Tories, and the distinction being that it's like the employers, where they've got large workforce, possibly on fairly low pay, that real wages can be lower if there's more benefits, and that the Labour Party generally going to provide more benefits. So the actual gross pay for your employees is less. And I don't know, that distinction may have been blurred over the years. We always had that impression that, even before Thatcher came along, that the Tory party didn't care much about manufacturing at all. And then it became policy, it became explicit. And Thatcher believed that the way out of the recession in the late 70s, early 80s was through the services sector and new technology. And it didn't really matter about manufacturing. We can import all our goods. Let's just concentrate on services. That's all really. Thanks.
No, I mean, Steve is right that Johnson has upset manufacturing capitalists, but not just those that voted against Brexit, but even those that voted for Brexit. They're saying he's economically illiterate and he doesn't know what he's talking about and so on. I mean, these are people. The minority section of industrial capitalists or industrial and retail capitalists, even they're annoyed with him. But of course, the people that are not annoyed with him, the financial people that finance the Brexit campaign, they don't employ anybody. They couldn't care less what happens to the section of the capitalist class which does have to deal with wages for people and so on. So I don't know. I think he's going to come unstuck at some time. But I mean, it does bring out what we've been talking about, that there are different sections of the capitalist class with different sectional interests, and they vie with each other for control of the government. But I think the historically the Labour Party is a successor of the Liberal Party. I mean, it was before the First World War. After the First World War, lots of Liberal MPs and supporters and voters came over to Labour. So I think you can see Labour as the that would be why they inherited support for manufacturing capitalism.
Thank you, Adam. I'm ahead of you, Dougie. I'm going to ask Adam, what do you think of the news this week, The Guardian and the Washington Post, etc., and the other journalists, bringing to life all the hidden wealth that the multi-millionaires and the multi-billionaires have been keeping from tax? I mean, isn't this a case of wealthy wolf? The rich, the really rich will sort of eat up anybody that's not. This has really large implications for the working class in the world, because these are world people.
Well, they're tax dodging, but the people that suffer, of course, are other sections of the capitalist class that can't tax dodge. So that's why people are upset about it. I don't think it makes any difference as far as workers are concerned. They're just two sections of the capitalist class arguing over who should pay for the upkeep of their government. But I mean, it does. I think we were discussing this on the editorial committee. And, you know, Paddy came up with a good headline. You know, latest news, the rich are rich.
A bit cryptic. Dougie, you want to speak?
Well, what I was going to say, I remember one of the Liberal leaders talking to the CBI, and he actually said we want Britain to be a low-wage, low-tax economy or whatever. And now you've got Boris saying we want high wages. But really, I mean, there's jobs that, I mean, they call these jobs unskilled, but they're very necessary jobs. I mean, even call nurses unskilled. And a couple of nurses saved Boris's life, really, you know. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's ridiculous the way Boris is talking, and even the capitalists, the Adam Smith Institute's gone against him or whatever. You know, saying he's talking a load of nonsense, really. You know, but I think the capitalists want low taxes because they realise it's the capitalists that pay taxes, and they'll want low wages so they can make more profit, right? You know, so the Liberal guy that said that to the CBI, trying to think of his name, is probably more in tune with what the capitalists want. And as to health systems like America, you know, where you've got I remember talking to an American woman at a meeting in Manchester, and she had to keep paying her insurance for healthcare in America, because if she went back and she hadn't paid it, it would cost her a fortune, really. So even although she could get free healthcare here, when she went back to America, if she cancelled her policy, it would have cost her a fortune, really. You know? So that's one of the problems for workers in America, really.
I see somebody's typing again. Mark, come on in.
Yeah. So I have to admit that I just do not understand the argument about taxation. I don't understand the statement. Actually, Doug just repeated it. I was not going to ask Adam about it. But maybe Adam, you could develop that a bit more. This issue about that the capitalists pay taxes, not the workers. And maybe I could just expand that question with, for example, the question of, you know, value-added tax. Because generally speaking, at least in the way that it's discussed, value-added tax is regarded as something that actually impacts workers more than, you know, capitalists or richer people. Because obviously it's not income connected, so everybody has to buy, you know, certain basic things, and that has, let's say, 23%, whatever the VAT rate is on it. And if you are a richer person, then obviously your element of that, you know, that cost is much lower to you than it is to somebody else who earns less. So, that, you know, very often people say how VAT is a regressive tax compared to income tax. I mean, it's obvious that in a PAYE system, the person earning doesn't receive the money that they pay in tax, because it's taken in, you know, by the employer. I mean, that's the mechanism of payment. And for example, myself as a self-employed person, I get paid, you know, theoretically the full value of what I do. And I have to pay tax on that. But I mean, at the end of the day, just because there's a different mechanism in the PAYE system, does that, I don't know how, well, that isn't proof to me that the burden falls on the capitalist rather than on the worker. And I'm not really sure what the significance of that is anyway in the whole scheme of things. So I actually don't understand the argument about taxation. And why do we need to argue that it's not the worker who pays, but the capitalist? I don't understand how that fits into what relevance that is to any discussion that we may have with people regarding capitalism or socialism. So, I mean, I'd love it if Adam could perhaps help me out here. I'm not trying to be difficult. I just don't understand the point. There probably is a point, but I just don't understand it.
That was the whole point of the talk. No, but I mean, the real point is that wages are tied to the cost of living. That's what happens under capitalism. Workers are never going to get much more what it costs them to recreate and maintain their labour power. That's the basic argument. So anything that increases their cost of living is going to exert an upward pressure on wages. Anything that decreases will exert a downward pressure. I mean, that's the main argument. So even if workers did pay, well, they do pay some taxes. Even if they paid income tax directly from their from their wage packet, from their salary check or whatever it is, or take home pay, then it wouldn't make any difference. Well, what the argument is, not so much that workers don't pay taxes, but that the burden of taxation in the end falls and can only fall on the employers. That's the main idea. But of course, you as a self-employed person are in a different position. I mean, that all sorts of taxes can be imposed on the self-employed, because there's no you're not subject to the law of wages. I mean, that was the basic point I was trying to get over. Now, some indirect taxes, do increase the cost of living. That's undeniable, but it doesn't make much difference in the. If all the taxes, if VAT was abolished, it was imposed on income tax, it would still be an economic fact that wages are never going to be much more than enough to allow workers to the cost of living is the cost of living as a worker. That's it. I don't want to sound too mechanical about this, but perhaps I am. But it also has to be pressure from workers to ask for more money, wages, and pressure to resist, downward pressures. But basically, that's what happens. That's why it's our case against reformism. All these proposals that are made, free services and handouts from the state and so on, or cheaper food, they won't work in the long run or in the medium term, because they'll have an effect one way or the other on the cost of living, and taxes is just another example of one of the things which can affect the cost of living. But there was another point I made about the pay as you earn system. It enables a sort of redistribution of the wages bill amongst the workers. It's if you like, enables employers to pay less to a single person than they have to a person with dependent children. It has that advantage. In fact, I think our pamphlet was actually, which we brought out on this, was called Beveridge Reorganizes Poverty.
Right. Could I just come back on that, Chairman?
Briefly, please. Yes.
Very briefly. Yeah. I mean, I have a feeling that what you're talking about, Adam, is about, as it were, justifying and defending the labor theory of value. So going back to actually almost back to what the very first statement was, that value is created by humans, working on the materials that exist in nature. And I think but whether we need to, I'm just wondering, I mean, I have a feeling that it is a mechanical argument to sort of say, to argue about the tax. I mean, the whole thing it's more or less saying that, well, I feel it's like a logical chain of argument, but I'm not sure what the final purpose of it is. The labor theory of value is definitely something we want to be bringing out to show that, in fact, it's the world for the workers. It's the ones who produce the wealth, and to show that the capitalist class doesn't produce the wealth. It actually just has the leverage to control the workers. I think that is the essence of it, and the other elements, so by logical conclusion, the tax burden doesn't actually fall on the working class. I have a feeling that that somehow I feel that's could even be a reactionary position to hold. I can't argue it, but somehow something in me feels that that's wrong. But I mean, you know, that's my feeling on the subject, but I could be completely wrong, of course.
Well, it does follow from the labor theory of value, but even if you didn't have the labor theory of value, it would still be a fact like that the second slide I put up, the definition of cost of living, and the cost of living is tied to wages. That's an empirical fact. Anybody could observe whatever their theory of value is, but I mean, it does also be explained on the labor theory of value, but you can explain it on the basis of what actually happens even without the labor theory of value.
I'm just scrolling down again. Where are we now? Steve Finch, you're next.
Yeah, I just want to take slight exception with what, because I'm self-employed, and I don't get the full value of my labour or my labour power, because I'm in competition with other workers. The reason that I'm self-employed is because, or that I'm able to work self-employed, is because it's cheaper for the capitalist to employ me without any sort of employment rights or what have you. And I doubt very much that you get the full value of what you do. Somehow or other you're going to be losing out, mate. That's all.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I meant theoretically. I mean, yeah, I agree. Obviously, I agree.
Yeah, slip of the tongue, mate. Slip of the brain.
Okay. We're now 21:20. Janet, you keep coming into the speaking queue and then disappearing. If you just want to speak, just unmute. But if you don't, and nobody else wants to speak. Adam, is there any recent articles on this particular point? Because that was a very interesting talk you did. Well explained, and I could understand, most of it, and I'm not very good at economic theories. No answer. I think that's starting to wrap it up then. Here's Howard Moss. Come on, Howard.
No, it's okay. I've just found an article on the party's website from 1922 entitled Why Taxes Do Not Concern Workers. If people want to look at that, here it comes now. Long time ago. I did read it a long time ago myself as well. Can't remember whether I was convinced by it or not at the time, but people might want to have a look at it anyway.
Well, thank you, Howard. I was asking for any recent ones because we're not living just in England, the British National Health Service anymore, and there's quite a widespread of different ways of capitalism works throughout the world. I was hoping to Adam's typing something. Howard, that's ahead.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. You often come when I come in for the first time. I just wanted to say very briefly, whenever I've advanced this argument, in terms of the workers not being bearing the brunt of the tax burden, one of the issues that always come up is that I will often get the rejoinder, I pay my taxes, and the feeling behind it is often that people like to feel that they have a stake in the system. So I think one of the important aspects of the argument is that if workers don't pay taxes, they don't have a stake in the system. And that is actually something that gets people thinking. The other point that I wanted to bring up, I wasn't going to, but since I'm here, I will. The whole idea about the difference between the National Health in the UK and in Europe and in the Obamacare in America is that there is a huge ideological divide between America and the rest of Europe. And one of the really strong ideological points that has always constantly been made by the capitalist class in America is that they promote individualism. And this, in order to encourage the working class to take responsibility for themselves individually, that actually prevents them, or the idea is that it will prevent them taking collective action. And so they're promoting this idea in order to further capitalist interest. But by promoting this idea, it also means that they can't so easily take cognizance of how, in fact, systems like the National Health Service actually benefit capital, or how parts of sectors of industry can generally benefit capital because of the ideological process that they actually have over there, which we don't have so much here. So that's just all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Adam, do you want to say anything? Because you put something in the you put an article in there. Do you want to explain it a little bit?
No. I'm just going to follow on to something that Richard had said. Because there is a... I don't know who's making that noise.
Hud, can you mute, please?
I think this ideology does play a part in here. It's the myth of the taxpayer. If people think they're taxpayers, they think they've got a stake in the system. And you know, one thing is interesting. In the French word for tax is which they use is contribution. But before the French Revolution, it was impôt. Something that was imposed on them. So you can see that, you know, at one time people thought taxes are something that's imposed on them from outside by the government. Whereas what, you know, once you have liberty, equality, and so on, you're paying a contribution yourself. You're one of the taxpayers. So I think this ideological thing is important, actually, or is an element.
If I could just make a really brief comment about taxation and why it's very interesting what Rich was saying about people having a feeling as though they've got a stake in it because they claim to pay tax. Of course, the our case is. The working class produces all the wealth anyway, as Adam said right at the top of his talk. But we are still seeing a lot of confusion among the workers. And they're attracted, the capitalists are able to attract support for their campaigns to get, for example, what are they called? Amazon, all these people, Microsoft, that don't pay the first share of the taxes. And workers are getting involved in this, and it's just depressing to see them falling into that trap. That's all I was wanting to say.
Can I just say I just wanted to come back very quickly. Sorry about this, but on what Steve said about as a self-employed person, I was actually making the issue. I was referring to what Adam said about the difference between who bears the tax burden between a wage worker and a self-employed worker, and that was the issue I was getting at. And I was saying that according to Adam's argument, I'm getting the full value of my work. I wasn't arguing. I, in fact, as a working class person, I don't get the full value of my work. And that would be something I would go back to Adam on and ask. You know, by making such distinctions between self-employed and wage workers, isn't there a potential? I mean, I think we take the position that all people who live from their labor are working class people, and isn't making such distinctions for the sake of the taxation argument, isn't that potentially, you know, bringing divisions in the working class? You know, very often in other traditions, Marxist traditions, people who are self-employed are called like petty bourgeois and things like that. You know, I know you're not arguing that, Adam. And the other thing is it, you know, if people say that the capitalists are not contributing, but you know, because they're in different ways escaping from the tax burden, which at least to most people's eyes falls on the working class. I mean, why is that a bad argument? I mean, it differs from the argument that's been made this evening, but it still argues that the capitalist class are being parasitic. So for me, that doesn't necessarily need to actually be an argument that leads to people embracing capitalism, it could equally be an argument that could lead people to see that within capitalism, the actual the class that has all the benefits and all the money also bears the least burden. And again, so these things can be turned in different directions. But Adam, do you have an answer on this working class issue? Because that's one of our big distinctives, that we don't make distinctions in the working class, or at least that's one of the. And isn't there a danger of making such a distinction by arguing that the burden of taxes doesn't fall on the wage workers, it falls on the capitalist, but to the self-employed person it does, which in some way makes it aligns us with the capitalist. That was the argument I was making, Steve, not that I was saying that I believe that I get the full value of my work, which of course I don't believe I do.
Well, actually, I had more in mind peasants and artisans producing something physical. But I agree with you. The most people that are called self-employed in Britain are, in fact, don't get much more than they would get if they worked for wages. It's just a different form, a different what can you say, contractual status. So I mean, most people who are self-employed probably are members of the working class. But I was just drawing a theoretical distinction between somebody who, in fact, a farmer that owns their own land and works it on their own or with their family. They sell it, and they theoretically their income should be part to cover wages and a part to cover profits. But I mean, I don't want to carry that argument too far and say that you and Steve are petty bourgeois. Well, the other thing is about the some capitalists. I mean, most capitalists do pay taxes. Some capitalists don't. So I mean, the real people that are harmed in this are the capitalists that do pay taxes, and there you can find plenty of them to attack Amazon and Google and so on, and maybe they will eventually bring in legislation to make these people have their fair share of burden of the administrative side of capitalism. But we can't say that no capitalists pay taxes. I mean, all the capitalists that do are somehow more virtuous than those that don't. I don't think we've got much to say in this argument. It's not our argument.
Well, then, thank you very much. I'm afraid I'm going to have to go. I'm a bit over my time. Adam, I welcome this discussion being on the website when it comes on, because it's a very clear and concise explanation of a lot of capitalist ideas that I wasn't too clear on, and it really is quite good. And I'll have a look at that article on there. But thank you all very much. We have 17 here after nearly an hour and a half of economics. That's really good.
Thank you, Mike. Really well chaired. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for the very interesting meeting.
Thanks very much indeed. Yeah.